BioCentury This Week is brought to you by Jato Capital, a global leading independent private equity fund dedicated to biopharma. Jato Capital has built a patient benefit-driven approach aimed at financing and accelerating the development of groundbreaking medical innovation. Jato's unique investment strategy combines significant capital and expert support to companies and their management teams, ranging from clinical development to market access for cutting-edge innovations with one main objective: go faster for the patient. Learn more at jato.life.
Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team. I'm Stephen Hansen, Director of Biopharma Intelligence here at BioCentury, and joining me today are my colleagues,
Simone Fishburne, Editor-in-Chief,
Lauren Martz, Executive Director of Biopharma Intelligence,
and Karen Koch-Tusman, Director of Biopharma Intelligence.
On today's podcast, BioCentury's second quarter public markets preview, AACR highlights, and combining ADCs with protein degraders. But first, a few words about our upcoming conference, Grand Rounds, which we've just announced, that will take place from September 9th to 11th in Nashville. Simone, tell us a bit about the conference.
Oh, we're super excited about this conference. I'm sure Karen and Lauren may chime in. I'm sure they're excited as well. This is BioCentury's first R&D conference, and this one is focusing really on the academia-industry interface. And what we really want to be doing at this conference is, first of all, it's an interdisciplinary forum. We're going to have academics, physician scientists, investors, farmers, biotechs, and we really want to dig into some of the critical issues in translation, roadblocks, also opportunities where the solutions lie both in academic labs and in industry. We're not yet ready to disclose the full program, but a sort of example might be something like drug delivery. You know, what are the technologies that are going to be able to get next generation modalities to the right cell, the right location in the body, and really enable them to open up what those modalities can do? That's obviously something that is both technology and industry relevant. The other thing that we want to be doing here is bringing academics from all corners of the US and beyond, people who don't normally get to meet with VCs or find it hard, and put them together with VCs or investors and also farmers who are looking for early stage assets. And so we will have partnering meetings as well as content. Karen, do you want to add anything about why we're so excited?
Yes. This meeting is very exciting for me because I spend a lot of time at the academia industry interface. I run the distillery feature here at BioCentury, and every week we comb the academic literature for new innovations that represent translational opportunities. And oftentimes we are finding things that aren't affiliated with the company yet, or a very fledgling company that doesn't have a website yet. And we're looking to connect those types of innovators with the investor community and pharma community that BioCentury knows so well.
Well, no, that all sounds really fun. And especially, 3 days in Nashville sounds pretty good as well. So if you are an academic and you want to get involved, or if you were a VC and want to get involved, or if you just want more information about the conference, please see the show notes and you should be able to find more information there. Turning to our first topic, BioCentury's 2Q24 public markets preview, biotech is back. Well, sort of back. It is specifically biotech financings are back, as 1Q24 was the best quarter for raising public capital since the first quarter of 2021, with over $20 billion raised across all deal types, including $9 billion from follow-ons. What was sort of particularly noteworthy was the contribution of PIPEs to the total raised. It was the largest single quarter for PIPEs since BioCentury began tracking financings in 1993, with nearly $8 billion raised, besting the previous high watermark of $4.7 billion in the fourth quarter of 2020.
Stephen, I have a couple of questions about PIPEs. I mean, one of the things that was interesting is that a lot of the new momentum we've seen is from PIPEs, which almost matched follow-ons, as I recall from the data, terms of the first quarter, money raised. So the first thing I want to ask you about this is PIPEs have always been around. why is now the time that we're seeing these take off?
Sure. No, good question, Simone. So I think in some ways it was kind of a perfect storm, really, in that we had on one side, on the investor side, you know, one of the primary drivers for them was M&A. You know, we've seen $62 billion in M&A activity over the past 6 months. And given, you know, the downturn that we had seen, a lot of these companies were either majority owned or had heavy ownership from healthcare specialist investors. These are folks who are going to be taking, you know, the money that they get from these M&A activities and redeploying them back into the sector. And so all of this M&A meant that investors had a lot of cash on their hands and they were looking for new opportunities and ways to redeploy that. So you had it on that side, on the investor side, and then on the company side, obviously the bear market that we'd been in, there's still a lot of companies that needed to raise money. So it was kind of a perfect confluence here of companies that needed money and investors that really wanted to deploy money and were looking to do it sort of as aggressively as they could. And PIPEs happened to be one of the potentially more efficient way for them to deploy that capital, because a PIPE typically has a fewer number of investors. They're more able to get a larger allocation if you're an investor. And so, you know, it really kind of works better for the investor to get that money out and get that money working to do a PIPE.
So, Stephen, obviously it works well for the investor, and it's obviously better for the companies that are not being able to raise money. But do you see this metric, this way of this ratio of high PIPEs to, let's say, follow-ons as a sign of a little bit of a tough market? Do you expect that the market returning would mean that we would just see follow-ons be the preferred route to raising public money?
Yeah, I think so, because as I said, I think there was something of sort of a timeliness to this, in that we had such a large amount of capital that needed to be redeployed, and that's obviously not going to continue on sort of forever. So the way I was sort of thinking about it is you kind of have two buckets of PIPEs. One was the investor-driven PIPE, and one was a data-driven PIPE. I think the investor-driven ones are, in this moment, you know, was kind of happened. I don't think that we're going to see this continue throughout the rest of the year, but this is where you had investors calling companies or reaching out to banks or to the companies themselves and saying, I have $50 million, I have $100 million that I want to invest in your company. Let's find a way to make that happen. And so they were really the ones pushing for the company to raise capital or to do a financing that would allow them to invest. A lot of these were opportunistic deals. A prime example of this might have been Denali Therapeutics, where they raised $500 million in a PIPE that was led by the Baker Brothers. That firm, you know, had just recently netted about $9 billion in return from the recent sale of Seagen to Pfizer. And, you know, Denali had over 5 years of cash on hand at the end of the year. So, you know, we're not in need of raising money. So that, I think, was a clear example of how, you know, an investor was kind of putting cash to work. Another common scenario, though, that we saw was where a company has data coming, but they might be less sure of exactly how the market is going to react to that. What they would do is they would reach out to, you know, a small slate of sophisticated investors, give them an opportunity to look at the data under a non-disclosure agreement, and then if they like it, provides some validation of the data, and it also sort of ensures that the company can raise capital on the back of that data without relying on the market to either like it or not like it sort of after the data has been announced.
So very quickly on this, Stephen, because I know we discussed it. Some people think that that creates an unfair advantage. Tell us why that's not the case.
Sure. So before an investor sees anything, they have to basically agree to an NDA that they're going to get to see the data. And then once that happens, they are restricted from trading shares in that company, regardless of whether they participate in the PIPE or not, until that data is disclosed. So it is correct that they are getting access to non-public, potentially material information ahead of other investors. But they're unable to act on that until it is publicly disclosed and also available to other investors. Just to quickly clear up any misconception there that they have some advantage. You know, even if you decide that you're not going to participate in that PIPE, you still can't trade it. But I think, you know, these sorts of PIPEs also work well for companies where, as I said before, a lot of these companies were in need of raising money. And if you were to do a follow-on, even on good data, what can happen is investors can say, oh, they've had a good data event. That likely means that they're going to need to raise money. And so they may not buy in the aftermarket of that data because they'll be expecting a financing to come. And so you can get a lot more, you can have a more muted response to your catalyst than you might have had without a financing overhang. And so sometimes doing a pipe where you are announcing a financing concurrently with your data essentially removes that financial overhang, and you get a much better reaction to the data in the aftermarket. I do think the data kind of bears that out as well. You know, we did an analysis that looked at the aftermarket performance for a pipe versus a follow-on, and pipes had a median aftermarket performance of 18% versus just 3% for follow-ons. So investors that participate in pipes on the whole did a fair bit better than those that did a follow-on.
Stephen, what about this trend of pre-funded warrants that you saw in the first quarter?
Yeah, thanks, Lauren. So about 30% of the pipes that were raised with at least $50 million in the first quarter included the use of these pre-funded warrants. Now, historically, warrants are typically an instrument that are used as a sweetener, kind of to get investors to participate in a deal because it gives them an option to buy additional shares at what they hope will be sort of a cheap price. But these are not the same. For a company, a pre-funded warrant is essentially no different than issuing common stock because they effectively raise the same amount of money with a pre-funded warrant as they do with a normal share. But for some investors, it can be a really useful instrument for managing their portfolios, particularly if they're already have an ownership stake in the company that's raising the pipe. Really what it comes down to is it's a way for them to avoid running afoul of what's called the short swing profit rule. So Section 16 of the SEC rules essentially restricts insiders from buying and selling shares at a profit within a 6-month time frame. Now, obviously, insiders typically refers to, you know, management or board members of the company, but the insider's rule can also apply to any shareholder that owns more than 10% of a company. And pre-funded warrants don't technically count against an investor's ownership stake until they're exercised. So just as a quick example, an investor can hold a 9.9% stake in a company and subsequently buy pre-funded warrants in a pipe. That way, the investor could in the future sell, you know, let's say 3% of their shares for a profit, and then they can exercise the warrants to bring their ownership stake back up to 9.9%. And all of this allows them to basically make a profit on those shares without breaking that 10% threshold. There are other reasons. I had a couple other people say that sometimes they like these warrants because it helps them to keep a bit more anonymity about kind of what they own. But, you know, what I heard from investors were predominantly most of the time it's to prevent breaking this 10% threshold. Great. Well, now let's turn to drug development. The American Association for Cancer Research kicked off its annual meeting on Friday in San Diego. Lauren, Karen, I know you both have been looking closely at some of the data that's being presented at AACR. What have you found?
Thanks, Stephen. So one of the topics that we're exploring this year in the abstracts is new modality therapies for glioblastoma. This builds on some very early hints of efficacy from phase one trials of CAR T cells in the indication. So solid tumors have been very challenging for CAR Ts. Glioblastoma itself is a very challenging indication because of how heterogeneous it is, because of the location of the tumors and how aggressive it is. But before the meeting, a few research groups have shown a durable response here and there after a CAR T cell therapy. I think there's sort of a sense of a small, quiet building momentum here. The message is that a cell therapy strategy might work for this very challenging tumor type. Maybe not exactly the cell therapies that have been developed, but there are also some clear hypotheses for how to sort of build on the data that already exists. And one of those is the idea that these tumors are expressing lots of different antigens in the brain. We probably have to target multiple antigens to address this type of cancer. So sort of step one seems to be finding new CAR T cell targets in the indication. So an analysis of the abstracts identifies a couple of targets that haven't been discussed before for CAR T cells. And we also looked into if CAR T cells are making progress here, what other modalities are as well. There are some antibody drug conjugates. There's at least one abstract with a bispecific for the indication. There are a few miRNA therapies. So it was interesting to see how these modalities that have made progress in other cancer indications are starting to expand to some of the more challenging solid tumor types as well.
Lauren, I know that you mentioned just now about new targets potentially as cell surface antigens for, say, a CAR T cell to go after. Are there other new targets you're seeing that get at sort of the internal workings of the glioblastoma?
Yeah, good point, Karen. So we also looked at new targets specifically for glioblastoma, and these would be any targets that, according to our BCIQ database, have not been tested in the clinic for any cancer indication. And we found 37 proposed for glioblastoma. And these range sort of mechanistically from metabolic, the targets that disrupt the metabolic pathways. There are quite a few immune targets. So lots of groups are trying to figure out how to make immuno-oncology drugs and things like that work in brain tumors. And the other big category was targets that control regulation of gene expression. So transcription factors, translational modifiers, and things like that.
Thanks, Lauren. And Karen, I think you were looking at some of the presentations around ADCs. What specifically were you digging in on?
Thanks, Stephen. So yeah, while Lauren took like a disease-focused approach with glioblastoma, I took sort of a technology-focused approach looking at antibody-drug conjugates, and in particular, this sort of Cambrian explosion of modality formats for the ADCs. You know, it's interesting to see the emergence of, on one hand, sort of novel vector types. So taking the plain old antibody of the antibody-drug conjugate and riffing on that with bispecifics, biparatopics, and smaller proteins, peptides, things like that. But then also what I've focused a bit more on is this question of novel payload types. So traditionally, the payload part of the ADC is where the field has, up until quite recently, sort of innovated less. There's kind of this stock set of tubulin polymerization inhibitors, of DNA replication inhibitors. And you definitely have a lot of improved versions of those, and we saw those in the AACR abstracts. But what I chose to focus on was a broadening of the payload type. So cytotoxics that don't work through those tried and true mechanisms, immune stimulating agents. And of course, Lauren took a deep dive on that with her sort of innate immune stimulating ADC story a couple weeks back. The sort of more targeted approach in terms of a targeted inhibitor or targeted degrader as a payload. And then, of course, the radiopharmaceuticals world plays into this as well with a lot of sort of antibody radio conjugates. Separately, I'll be diving into some radiopharmaceutical advances at AACR.
I know you just had a story on ADCs and their combination with protein degraders and really dove into some of the benefits that can come from that combination. Can you maybe give us a bit of a deeper dive on that specific combination?
Sure. So it was really interesting to dive into this emerging space of degrader antibody conjugates, or DACs. And what the take home is about that space is that it's a target modality on top of a targeted modality. So you have the tissue targeting of the antibody, and then you also have potential for tissue specificity in terms of the protein that is degraded by the degrader. And so there's all these different ways I get into the story about how the ADC format benefits from having a degrader be its payload with greater specificity, but also the degrader format benefits as well. There's a specificity advantage there, but also it enhances the delivery of the degraders into cells. And that's an area where degraders, because especially the heterobifunctional ones, the ones we call PROTACs, they tend to be larger, more hydrophobic, and a lot of optimization had to be done to try to get those into the cells. And so when you sort of remove that constraint by letting the antibody take over about cellular internalization, you open up a broader chemical space for the degrader itself.
So Karen, tell me how this compares, you know, in terms of a bystander effect. We know that ADCs normally benefit from a bystander effect where what happens is the molecule attaches, the antibody is absorbed, and then the payload basically explodes the cell, as it were, and can now go and, you know, do its business on surrounding cells. When you have something that's highly targeted, like a protein degrader, do you still get, I understand you get a catalytic effect inside the cell, but do you still get that bystander effect? Or is that a slight disadvantage compared with regular ADCs, but you win on the targeting in the first place side?
Well, I think it's one of these things where it's all tunable. Speaking to companies in this space, for example, Firefly and others, there's a sense that you can tune the payload, the degrader, to be more or less conducive to a bystander effect, sort of depending on what you need with, for the indication. And now with the degrader antibody conjugate format, there's more things to tune. On one hand, that can be helpful for getting a target product profile you want. On the other hand, one of the things that emerged from the analysis is that, you know, optimizing an ADC is challenging enough. Optimizing a degrader is challenging on its own. And optimizing the combination of the two is a big sort of empirical combinatorial challenge. And so it is not for the faint of heart, which is what one of the companies in the space told me. But I encourage everyone to check out the story and sort of read into the nitty gritties of what it takes to make DAX happen.
Perfect. Great. Well, thanks, Karen. Links to all of the stories we discussed today can be found in the show notes. Don't miss the latest episode of The BioCentury Show. Go to BioCentury's YouTube channel to hear Bio CEO John Crowley in conversation with Washington editor Steve Usden about why Bio reversed its opposition to the BioSecure Act and how it hopes to negotiate changes to the bill that will mitigate its negative consequences for biopharma companies and patients. Kendall Square Orchestra provides the music for BioCentury this week. The group connects science and technology professionals and other members of the Greater Boston community to collaborate, innovate, and inspire through music while supporting causes related to healthcare and education.
BioCentury would like to thank Jato Capital for its continued support of our BioCentury This Week podcast and our 24th annual BioEquity Europe Conference this May in San Sebastian.